This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Turning a real person into a fictional character changes how writers and readers feel about him. That's just one of the many discoveries the authors of Donald made while they were writing their book. The novel is an allegory that imagines how former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld might react if he were abducted and imprisoned in a place similar to Guantanamo and Bagram. The book came out earlier this month on the same day that Rumsfeld published his own memoirs. One of the two authors of Donald is Eric Martin. He's a 1991 Duke graduate who now lives in Durham and here today to talk about his book. Eric, welcome to State of Things.
Thanks. Nice digs you have here.
It's a nice spot.
It is nice. It's
Durham
very comfortable.
Durham has come around since you left.
Durham is cozy.
And now you're back. Donald, less straightforward. Donald is a book that looks at a fictional account of what might have happened. How did this book come about?
Well, it started when a friend of mine invited me to join a fictional think tank. And as you know, if somebody invites you to join a fictional think tank, you have to join.
Got to do it. Yeah.
Right. The think tank's purpose was to take a Wesley Clark quote about a memo that he saw in the days after 9/11, that he said he'd seen a memo that laid out a plan to invade 7 countries in the next 5 years. And so our job was to write write persuasive essays about why each country should be invaded. And it was sort of a contest between the writers who could have the most persuasive argument. And I did Pakistan, which I thought was very, very persuasive. Anyway, the point was kind of to show that these arguments could be made from a neocon perspective about invading these different countries. It was a great book. It didn't get a lot of play. It was a little weird. But then Steve comes back to me, Steve Elliott, my co-author on Donald, and who edited that book. And he said, I have this other idea. What if we wrote a novella, a little book about Donald Rumsfeld going to Guantanamo? And he didn't mean visiting Guantanamo. He meant going to Guantanamo. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. I'd been thinking about what fiction could do that nonfiction couldn't. And I'd been thinking about the allegorical novel. I'd been thinking about the thriller. I'd been thinking about taking real research and putting it into novels and what you could do with it. And so I thought, well, what if we just super collide all this stuff into this nice little book? And see what happens.
And what did happen? Give us a synopsis.
Well, the plot is fairly simple. And the plot is really based on taking the two ingredients, the two major ingredients that went into the book are the Rumsfeld biography and then the accounts of prisoners who have gone through the system. We read a lot of accounts. We read a lot of books, including Mozambique's book about his experience. And the plot basically follows what happens. We had a bunch of interns from McSweeney's, which is the publishing company we were doing it with. And they went out and we asked them, we said, give us a pipeline of what happens from the moment you get taken to the moment you either end up in a tribunal or get released. And they laid it out for us. And so that is the plot that it follows. So he gets abducted from his home. He gets taken to a prison somewhere overseas. He gets moved to another prison on an island. And he gets interrogated by lots of different agencies over time. He doesn't know why he's being held. He's never charged. And he can't quite figure out who has been doing this to him. But he created this system. And he knows the system. And so there's this thriller aspect of him trying to figure out how to get out, you know. He's a smart guy, and he's canny, and he doesn't give up, and so he's sort of trying to get out at every turn.
And not the worst of atrocities happened to him. He doesn't suffer the worst that could happen under these circumstances.
No, he doesn't. We decided to limit what happens to him to experiences that happen to a lot of people, and some of the most egregious things that happened did happen to a very limited number of detainees. And we decided that in the end, we didn't have to go there, that you could show really a more usual, regular experience, and that it would still be sort of jolting enough that the reader would sort of be shocked that these are the things that we had been doing to people in prisons.
Will you read for us?
Sure. I'm going to read from this is the first so after Donald gets kidnapped and taken away, he's taken to a house and he comes to in a room, and this is his first contact with an interrogator. Donald, can hear people walking past the door. But maybe an hour passes before anyone comes in. The man who enters is not young, not as old as him, but not as healthy either. He is 76. This man is barely 60. White-haired, stooped, a mid-level civil servant. He's met lots of men like this. They're smart enough, but they lack ambition. Maybe they had ambition once, when they were 20, but then they had children, took out loans, they lost their sleep and edge. Fat and happy, yet beaten down all at the same time. Tangled in their anchor chain. The man is poorly dressed, except for a beautiful tie. An old world bureaucrat, Donald thinks. I'm going to survive. The man sits on the chair in front of him, a clipboard on his lap with regular A4 paper. Twitchy. It takes considerable willpower to wait for the man to speak first, but he waits. He sinks his breathing up and holds the man's eyes firmly, although what he would like to do is rip them from their sockets and pop the jelly out. "What's your name?" the man asks. "Donald," he says. "What's yours?"
Eric Martin, one of the co-authors of the book Donald. He read from that just now. You got to know Donald Rumsfeld well. You talked about knowing the process of intake in Guantanamo and other places, but you understood his biography pretty well too.
Yeah, you know, this is a guy who people were very interested in. There were five biographies written about him since 2002. And lots of YouTube clips. He was an over-communicator. There was so much information about him. And yes, at the beginning, I didn't know much about him. I was fascinated by him, but I learned about he was a wrestler. He was a pilot. He was a young politician. He worked for Nixon. He worked for Ford. He was in every administration except for the senior Bushes, really, and Clinton and Carter. And but as I got to know him at this level of watching the clips and seeing how he looks to his left when he's thinking, or how he turns these imaginary knobs in the air when he's explaining something technical, the way that his lips would tighten up when he really had disdain for the person that he was talking to. Also a very complex guy, because he made enemies on all sides. You know, he made enemies on the right. He made enemies on the left. The generals didn't like him for his vision for the military. He wasn't afraid to contradict himself, and that's what made him an interesting character to see what happens when he becomes the victim. And I think that was the interesting thing, because what you realize is when somebody is tortured, you become sympathetic for them no matter who they are.
Well, it's interesting because the Washington Post, for instance, in its review says that you've attempted something here more daring and risky than a brief flight of revenge fantasy. So this is not necessarily wish fulfillment for those who had opposed that policy and didn't like Donald Rumsfeld, in a sense, because of that empathy that did you generate in the book. Did that surprise you? Did you find yourself saying, what's happening here in this book?
I was surprised, although it happened fairly quickly. I think after the first hook of sort of like, oh yeah, Donald Rumsfeld gets tortured, the minute that became even remotely real, or fictionally real at least, it became kind of upsetting. And realizing what was happening in the prisons and imagining what the experience of somebody, even somebody really strong and, you know, who really understood the system, understood what was happening to them. Even that was kind of a terrifying experience to see this character go through. And I did. I became both sympathetic and empathetic for this Rumsfeld guy, and for Donald, who he really became a character that was ours even more than this person in the world.
And then how did you go about? Was it the research what helped you create the inner dialogues he has? He talks to himself too.
Well, it's funny, this morning I was cleaning off my desk with all my notes from the book, and I ran across this long, long list I made at the very beginning of all these different sayings and all of Rumsfeld's rules. He was famous for if you understand the objectives, a lieutenant can write the strategy. You know, the higher monkey climbs, the more you see of his behind. There are tons of he had all these rules about that, sort of about life. And I had this huge long list of the big ones and the short ones, and I saw that I had at some point made a check mark of all the ones that were actually in the book. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens in there. So what it ended up being, and I'd almost forgotten that, so what it ended up being this weave of his own words, with the things that we were bringing in for this circumstance. But so many of the things he said applied to the circumstances that he finds himself in. You know, things like your enemy is never who you think it is, or no plan survives contact with the enemy, or you know, all of these things that he would say about the situation that he finds himself in that he said in other contexts, right, which brought in here was like his voice. And so it was right, almost like you start as a ventriloquist, and then as you train your writing voice to assume that voice, you start to bring in your own stuff. And there was another reviewer that said, I have this feeling that there's real quotes in here and I can't tell what's real and what's not.
Classic example of blowback. Here you are talking about the enemy and all of this comes back on yourself.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. But also another paradox in here, you talked about the sympathy that you feel for Donald going through a process and a machinery that he created, and yet you're sympathetic when he's a victim because it's not pleasant. But when you think about the actual policy and some of the bad people who were brought through that process, it has that effect as well.
Yeah, and a couple of things there. I mean, I think writing a book about torture, we were trying to figure out a way to write a book about torture that people might actually want to read. So it has this plot and this thriller aspect to it. But what you realize is that a couple of things. Once you open the box on torture, you feel like you can control it. I mean, and look at Egypt. You feel like you can use it in certain circumstances, just use it on the really, really bad guys. But almost in every historical case, it ends up being used on your own people. And you can't control it. It's one of these things you think you can be the one to control it. But once that box is open, you can't. And so Donald finds himself, the guy who shouldn't be tortured, being tortured because that box has been open. And now these interrogators feel like they need to use whatever tool they have to get the information that they need, even though, you know, he doesn't know anything about what they want to tell him.
You also raise the possibility that in some segment of the viewing public, of those who get this experience through the media, that you generate some sympathy for some very bad people. There are people out there who want to harm the United States of America.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing. When you start to see things, as I did, from this Donald's perspective, you realize there's a lot of truth to the argument that weakness is provocative and strength is important and the world is a dangerous place. And yet, one of the greatest disservices you end up feeling is that some of the torture turned people who shouldn't have been victims into victims. They turned people that we should have been focused on for the bad things they did or wanted to do into people to whom bad things were being done. And that was a huge disservice to us and really was one of the things that divided our country too, which is now the polls sort of show it's a 50-50 country in terms of torture.
How does Donald change as a result of his experiences?
He changes, well, not to give away too much, but
he changes.
He changes. He changes less than one might think he does, though. He, in a sense, after the book came out, I finally got my copy of the Rumsfeld memoir, which is an 800-page book that came out on the same day. We have a very similar cover, and I read his book, and I was struck by the way in which his own narrative is of a man who hasn't changed that much. And I think in his case, in the real Donald Rumsfeld's case, he changed more than he thought he did. And but at the point that this man arrives in this book, this Donald man, it's almost like he doesn't have any time left to change.
You obviously have some very definite views about torture, about the way we conducted this particular part of our foreign and military policy. Have your ideas changed any in writing this book?
I think I'm much more empathetic about the difficult decisions. I was thinking about your last guest and Fred, him talking about Kennedy and talking about the ability to empathize with the other, the ability to sort of see what other people are thinking, what their choices are. And I think there was that sense of looking at somebody like Donald and actually thinking about how hard it is to be in that room with some very bad choices in front of you and trying to pick the best of the bad choices. And I think that definitely did happen.
You studied with a number of actually some pretty impressive names at Duke in terms of writing. Do you tell us who they are and if you still feel their influence?
Sure. I mean, the two main people were Reynolds Price and Ariel Dorfman. And in fact, within within months of returning to Durham, I came back here in 2009. I ran into Ariel in the park, and I was struck. I didn't talk to him about the book at the time because I was really deep into it, but I was struck by the way in which my study with him really set me on this path that I'd worked my way back to. He's a very political writer. He's a writer that encourages his students to see the politics in everything, but also a person who encouraged you to say that fiction has to do that something that nonfiction doesn't. And that's what I was doing.
A deep tradition of allegorical writing.
Deep tradition of allegorical writing, Latin American writing, which I was introduced to here through him. And in so many ways, Durham became a strange full circle in that way, to come back here and a place that's changed a lot, such a huge creative community here. And I felt I wanted to I really wanted to finish this book here, even at times when I thought I might not be able to sort of have it be my Durham book, to come out and say, I'm part of this creative community. I'm contributing something. Here's what I have.
Eric, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot. I did want to say one thing about our event tonight at the Pinhook.
Sure.
Which should be a great event, a great reading. And there'll be music there, too. I don't know if you were just about to talk about it.
I was, but it's okay to repeat that. Eric,
I'm going to do your job for you.
That's great. You want to hear? Finish out. No. Eric Martin, thanks so much for being with us. Co-author of the novel Donald, a fictional account of Donald Rumsfeld's imprisonment. As you may have just heard, Eric is going to talk about that book tonight, 8 o'clock at the Pinhook in downtown Durham. You didn't say that. And there's going to be music. Thank you for listening. By the way, we are going to be in Greensboro this Friday for a special broadcast at the Triad Stage. We're going to get an update on the news from Triad. Famed Russian conductor and musician Ignat Solzhenitsyn will be there. We're going to hear some live music from the band Songs of Water. All of that in Greensboro, Triad Stage. We'd love to have you in the audience. It's free. Reserve a seat. RSVP at WNC.org. Hope to see you there. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.